Hey, everybody, it's Adam Ray for the About Last Night podcast. Thank you so much for listening to the show, giving us those five-star ratings on iTunes and your comments. Man, some killer comments lately. I'm going to start reading some of these in the next few episodes. They're really beautiful and heartfelt, and we really appreciate it. Fans of the week from the last episode, you got to shoot me an email, aboutlastnightpod@gmail.com, so we can send you your free ale and merch. And thanks for listening. A lot of dope episodes we've had in the last few weeks. Susan Sarandon, Goo Goo Dolls, Melissa McCarthy, Brent Morin's seventh appearance has been very well received. So go back and listen to all those episodes on iTunes. Subscribe, give us a five-star rating and comment on the iTunes page. Today's episode, holy shit. I don't know if you ever watched Distraction on Comedy Central or you're just a fan of amazing stand-up comedy, but our guest today, one of the biggest comics in the world, he has a new Netflix special out called Funny Business right now that you can get on Netflix. He tours all over. He's about to start a big American tour in the U.S., which he's just kind of peppered in for festivals here and there. But if you're a fan of comedy, you know him. He's one of the best. He's known for his amazing deadpan delivery and one-liners. And I'm talking about the one and only Jimmy Carr, baby. Holy shit. How do we get him on the podcast? Well, Brad has done shows with him in Montreal, did a show with him while we were in Austin at the Moon Tower Festival, and he was kind enough to record an episode in the lobby of our hotel. And shit, man, it was awesome. The guy's the man. From how he started comedy in London to how he did some shows called like 100 like worst pop stars, kind of like the English version of you know best week ever or I love the 90s, shit like that. And he got his start on those. And his story where he grew up being a funny kid in elementary school to transitioning to comedy in the U.S. and dude, he's just so funny. He's one of the best, and if you haven't seen him live, hopefully you get a chance to when he comes to your city. I don't want to keep this intro too long. I'm trying to keep him shorter per some of your guys' very combative tweets, but I read them and take them in. So anyway, enjoy this episode. It was a lot of fun. Jimmy's the man. Follow Jimmy on Twitter @JimmyCarr. Follow me on Twitter @AdamRayComedy. Follow Brad on Twitter @FunnyBrad. And go see Brad May 20th through May 22nd at the San Jose Improv in San Jose, California. Get your tickets at improv.com. I will be in Las Vegas headlining the Laugh Factory at the Tropicana Casino May 23rd through the 29th. Very pumped about that. Come out and see me. It's Memorial Day weekend. So come to Vegas, come party, and come see me at the Laugh Factory at the Tropicana May 23rd through the 29th. Tickets at AdamRayTV.com. Also on May 20th, I'm sure you know, I'm sure you've heard, Brad Williams' second Showtime special, Daddy Issues, premieres May 20th on Showtime. Set your DVR and watch Braddy crush it. I was there live. I opened for him. I intro'd him on stage. It was an amazing thing to watch, and you guys are going to love it. We'll be releasing next week a bonus backstage episode that we recorded pre-show with myself, Brad, and his manager, Barry Katz, two-time guest of the ALN podcast. So be on the lookout for that. And watch Brad's special, May 20th, Daddy Issue, Showtime. Of course, ALN merch, estoymerchandise.com, estoymerchandise.com. Get all your merch, bring it to the shows. We'll sign it, mugs, posters, hats, whatever you guys want. And you could have a chance to become fan of the week with all your ALN support. And of course, Separation Anxiety, Tuesday nights, TBS, 10 p.m. Please tune in. It's going to be a great handful of episodes to close it out. So tune in, DVR, TBS, 10 p.m., Separation Anxiety, Tuesday nights. I got another show I just booked, actually. A Hank Azaria baseball show for IFC that is I'm going to shoot in Atlanta for 5 weeks. I'm really pumped. I'm going to play a baseball player on a Hank Azaria comedy. I'm so pumped. I just found out last week, so I'm telling you guys. Anyway, it's going to be awesome. More details to come on that. Brad's Netflix movie with Christopher Guest, Mascots, I think, is coming out soon. Some more details on that. But for now that we got the Twitter handles out of the way, those are the tour dates. Those are the merch infos. And now sit back, relax, and enjoy a brand new episode of the About Last Night podcast with the one and only Jimmy Carr.
Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it. Got a midget and a Jew, so why don't you sit? a dope podcast during lunch, dinner, or breakfast. Brad Williams and Adam Ray are here for you any time of the day. So come on and treat yourself right. It's about last night.
Where do you stay when you come to this festival?
I'm in this hotel.
Oh, are you? Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's mediocre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've bragged to me of your condo in London. So does this like is this
condo?
Condo.
Just remember that.
Yeah,
it's a fucking mansion, son.
I don't know. Flats? Is it a mansion?
I suppose if you ever go on Cribs, there's a chance it might actually be a crib. You might be the first person in Cribs to actually sleep in a crib.
You should book an episode just to do that. I mean, I just revealed to Adam, and I forgot about it, that I actually once slept in a drawer. Not when I was a baby. But like in college, there was no room on any beds or couches, so someone pulled out a big drawer, threw down a sheet, and I just hopped in.
That's one of the benefits I gotta assume is like you can sleep anywhere.
We're portable.
Are you portable
humans?
I was looking at that little thing because I was flying a lot the last little while, mm-hmm. and American Airlines have got this sort of baggage thing where you can tell how big your hand luggage can be that you can take it on.
Yeah, right.
Are you hand luggage?
Because I just wonder
if I'm flying.
Yeah.
Could I put you in a hold all? And just,
yeah. I mean, to me, that would almost be better than a first class seat if I got that entire overhead storage bin.
You could stretch out.
Yeah, I could stretch out. Yeah,
no.
Put a reading light. You know, I'd be good.
I would like to just once, I think, as a gag,
yeah.
do that. Take you on as carry on. Like get
nobody's going
to
stop.
You need a pretty big guy to put you in a rucksack, but just to go look. Can we just?
Yeah, I mean, now would you put me on the X-ray thing?
Would I put you on the X-ray thing?
No, yeah. Or would you check them?
Yeah,
TSA. Because we would all,
but I'd also check you're okay. While we did that, I'd put you through there and go, yeah. Can we just check his?
Now you love these festivals.
I do like the festival. I mean, I haven't been to this one before. I normally, I love Edinburgh and I love Montreal. Montreal's really my favorite just for laughs. But this is lovely. It's a lovely thing to kind of come off the road and suddenly you come down and I bumped into Jim Norton, went for breakfast with him and you're on a podcast and you're doing a radio show. And
it's like comedy camp, right?
Yeah, and it does feel like we're all, you know, the fellow travelers. I really like that idea that we're... you know, my favorite description of comedians is in a room of, you know, 300 people with one person facing the wrong way.
That's pretty accurate.
We're
yeah.
kind of, we're a little bit off. We're all a little bit off, and it's nice when we come together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It almost feels very special. So it's like sharks. We're on our own most of the time, and then occasionally we get together to mate.
You say,
fuck Brad in a minute.
The first live on air fuck.
I mean, we haven't done that before, but no. I think we could use the ratings boost.
Well, this hotel seems very fuck friendly, if I can say that.
It seems fuck friendly.
Yeah, the lobby, fuck friendly for you guys to, penetrate each other. Yeah,
sure.
If you're gonna penetrate each other in the lobby, I would say this is the lobby. Well, maybe not. You just said it was mediocre earlier.
Yes. It's an odd line of questioning. I realize sort of the rules of improv is we should never say no. But I'm going to say no on that bit. That's a hard pass for me.
Brad and I were just talking about Edinburgh because I went for 6 weeks with...
You went to where for 6 weeks?
Edinburgh. Yeah, to
Edinburgh.
Edinburgh.
Let's get it right, shall we?
What did I say?
Okay. Edinburgh.
You said, yeah.
Well, we do have the American accent when we do it.
I like the accent down here. You don't pronounce the A in Texas.
No.
They just go, Texas. America.
Yeah, America.
America.
Texas.
America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
America, I'm fixing to go boot scooting.
Jesus, who says that?
Texans.
A lot of people. Would you have a favorite American accent?
It's yours.
I like that. There
yeah.
it is.
I don't know. I think the Southern is kind of beautiful. Yeah. I read a thing once that said that there's areas of Louisiana, like up to about 100 years ago, where they were speaking Dickensian English.
Wow.
There were small pockets where the accent really hadn't changed that much. There wasn't enough. Because the reason accents change, I think, is because different people move in.
Yeah.
And so, it, you know, it changes the makeup and accents kind of. Because the American accent's new.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we all came from the motherland.
Well,
Britain.
Well, we did, but I mean, presume you came from Narnia.
What tree did you fall out of?
It was enchanted.
Let's be honest.
Sure. Where did you guys meet? In Montreal?
We met in Montreal doing the Nasty Show a couple of years ago, which was a phenomenal bill. Looking back on it, it's like...
Wait, that was the first time... When I was there, that was the first time you met?
It was me.
You guys were phenomenal.
It was Bridget.
Bridget. Trying to follow either you or Bridget was just like, ah... Because it was such energy in the room, like of the show. Because you know, normally you go and see a comedy show and you go, yeah, I was like five comics. I liked the guy with a thing. The guy with the hat was good or whatever. Right. But it was such a distinctive show.
Yeah.
And Bridget doing, you know, What I Gotta Do. It doesn't get any... Doesn't get any better than that. Yeah, right? So good.
She set the bar.
There's a video on my Instagram of our entire green room in the back watching the monitor singing, What I gotta do, I gotta get the dick in my mouth.
Oh, yeah, I mean, she probably, yeah, she's doing some face sitting.
Yeah.
She's an extraordinary talent, actually.
She really is.
Like as a... It's kind of that thing of, I think she's from that tradition, but where performance art meets comedy. It's really, and not to say that in a, that would maybe put people off and go, that sounds a little bit pretentious. Like the most fun you could have in a room.
Oh, yeah. Like that's, the room is a wreck after she gets off stage.
Are those the comics and performers, like, what do you like to watch in somebody that maybe you, that you appreciate that maybe?
I suppose if I had like a type of comedian that appeals to me, it would be tall.
I like son of a bitch.
I like a
You're out, bro.
I like a bit of height on a comedian. I don't know. I mean, there's a weird thing. I saw Dimitri Martin play the other night. We had a show together, and it's a joy to watch someone do sort of one-liners. Because, you know, if you're a one-liner comic, you watch another one-liner comic. It's partly you enjoy it and think, oh, wow, this is incredible. And partly you tut. I should have thought of that.
Yeah.
Damn it. Damn it, that was right there. I've said that phrase a million times. So occasionally it's nice to like to fully enjoy something that you have no skin in the in the game.
Yeah.
The idea that you go and see an observational, great observational comic and go, well, this isn't even the kind of thing I do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm amazed at how they're spinning this out. I can't even see where the joins are.
Like Bill Burr, are you a Bill Burr fan?
Yeah, I really like Bill, yeah. I just think, you know what, I have an opinion about something, Bill. Come on,
you're passionate about something.
Pick a side.
So vanilla.
When did you kind of develop your? I think the first time I saw you was on the Tonight Show. But then what was a Comedy Central show?
Distraction.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was incredible.
That was a really fun show. We made a comedy show and they cut it as a game show. It's quite a funny game show, but it was a really funny comedy show the way we made it in the UK because it was much more banter and chatting to people.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is like what some like comedy shows miss out on. It's like you want that, like if you're putting comedians out, you want to put them in their element to have that banter. But so the States version kind of stripped
that
away.
Well, it was kind of, it was 21 minutes, 22 minutes. Yeah. I think Comedy Central did a pretty good job with it.
Yeah.
But I think it maybe should have been an hour long show and a lot more talking about the people.
Yeah.
Right. Because that's where the funny comes from.
Where did you develop though the one lighter, like dry, deadpan?
I didn't develop it. That's all I can write. That's all I've got. Yeah, I can't tell you a story.
Wow! I'm always fascinated by that. Like you're always fascinated by people that do something different than you.
Yeah.
And like we tell we're more storyteller based.
Yeah, you got to wait for shit to happen.
Yeah, like
I refuse to wait for shit to happen. I'll write it. I'll make it up.
Yeah, you can sit down and with just a piece of paper and a pencil, just create a joke from nothing.
I feel like it's basically Dustin Hoffman, Laurence Olivier, and the Marathon Man. You know that story?
No.
They're making The Marathon Man, and Dustin Hoffman has got this scene with Laurence Olivier where he's got to be out of breath because he's running and he sees him in the street. And so he runs around the block like five times to prepare for the scene and then walks up to Laurence Olivier like out of breath, and they do the scene and he's still out of breath after the scene, and Laurence Olivier just goes, "Have you tried acting?"
Wow.
Really harsh on the method.
Yeah, no kidding.
I feel like looking at you guys, I feel like, oh, you just have to look for weird shit to happen in your life.
Yeah.
You have to, at some point, you know, you're going to have kids on the basis that you go, well, I need another
new material.
Hour.
Yeah.
I'm going to Melbourne Comedy Festival next year. I need something. I better knock someone up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, when your girlfriend tells you, oh, I'm leaving you for another guy, you go, there's a silver lining here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can write.
Could you maybe fax me the breakup? Or you know, something. I want something that's like a technology from the recent past.
Yeah,
that seems kind of ideally.
Can the guy you leave me for have a great disability of some kind, or like some hook?
Yeah,
or maybe
an actual hook.
Yeah, I'm gonna be an actual hook. Something like
that. Something, anything.
Yeah. So like the way that we're conditioned to like after a while, I think just perceive things in our own life that, you know, and find the absurd in them to then talk about, like with the one. I mean, did you just start one day Like, were the people you saw that you go, oh, that's also my style?
Well, probably, you know, Emo Phillips and Stephen Wright, yeah. probably the best joke writers, maybe. I mean, it's, you know, Mitch Hedberg's very good. I wasn't aware of Mitch when I started, but the idea of, like, a great one-liner comic, it felt to me like when you went to see a show, like you would come away from seeing a comedy show, and I would say, oh, wow, there are three brilliant lines in there. He said this brilliant thing, and then a brilliant thing, and then he's just fabulous. And it felt to me like if you could do that in a, you know, it was originally kind of 10 or 20 minute sets, if you could have like just three of those a minute, it would be like this wave of, I was thinking from an audience point of view, how you enjoy the show.
Yeah.
For me, it's about, it's as much as anything, it's about that kind of volume of big laughs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One thing that you do, though, that I don't see in a lot of one-liner guys is, like, it seems like a lot of one-liner comics have a script. And they're just doing that, and they can't really adjust, like, because they're just, they've got their jokes. But you really kind of read the audience, and you will change the act.
I kind of think that's why everyone got into this. Everyone that does this is pretty good. Well, you know, whether it's high school or college or whatever, or in the bar, they're good with people. They're good at making their friends laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems to be. That's not to say that if you're the funny guy in the group, you can necessarily be a stand-up comedian. It's a very difficult thing to translate. It's a slightly different skill.
Yeah.
But it feels to me like most of us are pretty good with people. So the idea of just taking that skill, that's what I've practiced my whole life.
Okay.
So you were. I mean, this was your delivery, like one-liners. You would do that, like on the playground or in social settings, like.
No, but I would have. I always had a good turn of phrase. Yeah. But I was always very good at the audience stuff, at like heckling or dealing with people or taking the piss out of people. That is what I like to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's a weird. It's a weird thing with. I think men are very bad. A little bit emotionally stunted. No offense, dude. Not literally stunted.
That's the medical term for you, emotionally stunted.
We're not great at communicating. And I think, you know, a joke, in essence, is saying to another guy, I like you, and I hope that you like me. That's what telling a joke, you know, if your dad tells you a joke, that's what he's saying.
Yeah.
He's saying, I like you, and I want you to like me, and I want to make you happy. That's what he's saying. But men are incapable. Women would just hug each other. But men have got this kind of, that's kind of what they're using jokes for.
I hope we can both enjoy this together.
It's kind of a currency.
Yeah.
To it.
Yeah.
Like in a slightly different way.
And you talk about how you're able to deal with hecklers. I told you this morning, but I was fascinated that on your most recent special, which you can see on Netflix, Jimmy Carr, Funny Business.
It just came out, right?
Yeah.
Congrats.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And it's, you know what? It's great for them, I think. It's just, I really think this good. This is, they're going to turn a corner any day now.
Yeah. But like, you opened up the audience to heckle you.
Yeah.
I've never seen that. You just invited the audience to heckle you.
I tell a story, and then I say, okay, let's have a heckle amnesty. Just like they sneeze like regular people. which one are you now? You're doing them all today. You were grumpy earlier, weren't you?
I was.
Yeah.
Going the entire range.
I just love it. It's my favorite thing ever. Sneezy. Sneezy turned out.
I'll be sleepy right after this.
But then that heckle thing of like, okay, if you do a gig to 3,000 people and you're recording a Netflix special, the arrogance to think I'm the only funny person in here.
Yeah.
Like everyone that goes to comedy, pretty funny.
Yeah.
Like people that are boring and need comedy don't go. The really boring... Oh, I'm kind of depressed. You don't go out and see a comedy show.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of counterintuitive, but we're always preaching to the choir. I think we're preaching to people that are in a pretty good mood to start with.
Yeah, yeah.
9 times out of 10.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm.
And it's a lovely thing to kind of just share that and to have other people join in. It's lovely.
Do you have a favorite type of, I mean, have you gotten, you know, is there a certain type of heckler or person or line that someone's going to...
I just think sometimes people get sometimes someone in the audience, just the line, the timing is just perfect.
Yeah.
And I love it when they just get, they win. Oh. They just destroy.
You look with when the audience does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some little line or, you know, you look like a Lego Hitler or something. Some little throwaway comment. And
yeah,
you just
that
go,
was said.
Oh.
That Lego was, Hitler?
Yeah, he said, so someone yelled out that he looked like a Lego Hitler.
I do look a bit like a Lego Hitler. There's no getting away from it.
I mean, I'm not denying it.
I mean, and one thing I love
what
is that...
What are you denying? Hang on.
Wait a minute.
Hang on.
There's times when someone yells something out and... Like, you just have this comedic poker face where you have the line and you know it's going to crush, but then you're like pausing. Like, there was a point in the special where a guy yelled out, you look like you just had sex with a pig. And you paused and you just had this look like, I know I have it, but You just and you
do you always have it
back.
Or even like no. with your yeah
no but I mean you I think there's a weird thing about being on stage where you're thinking at three times the speed. There's something about the adrenaline and that situation where you can just come up with something. You're almost saying it before you get the joke yourself.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I've done that a couple of times where I've been quite tired and done a show and kind of done a heckle line to someone and it's been quite funny and I've kind of not really got it. But somehow muscle memory just kind of like comes from another place.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, your ability, I mean, the first thing I noticed about it is how, like, just I guess the confidence and the comfortability of, like, in those moments where you don't flinch and it's like your timing is so.
Are we letting comfortability go as a word?
Comfortability. Isn't that a word?
Comfortability.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it is now. We just have to work on a definition for comfortability.
Well,
I swear to God, that's a word.
You saw how
look,
good
I drank
my
during
English
the ping pong game today.
Yeah.
How did you do in the ping pong?
I won 11-0 my first game, and then I lost 11-4 the second game.
It's pretty bad.
I played a guy who was all. Are you a ping pong player?
I played in a tournament in Thailand, and the girls.
They're serious over there.
The girls' serve was just incredible. It was like it was quite off putting.
Did she use a paddle?
Huh?
She didn't use a paddle, did she?
I used a paddle later on that evening, yeah. Yeah, that's why I kind of like that.
I totally believed him for a second.
It's an unconventional serve. Yeah.
But the way that you, I guess, because that's one of the things that it took me a while to really figure out was getting comfortable in the silence. And you're brilliant at that. And I think it's like when even, like you just said, though, like you're not always, it's not always there right away, but.
Trust.
Trust.
I've got a friend, Tommy Tiernan, who's, I think, pound for pound, one of the funniest guys I've ever had the pleasure to see him. He's just incredible. He's an Irish comedian.
Yeah.
And he does this thing. Now, he's been doing a show where it's entirely improv. Like, he'll do an hour just. And he'll often do a thing in the show where he just goes very quiet and goes, just, Tommy, just wait now. It'll come. And, like, just waits for it to come. Waits for the muse to come. Waits for it just to arrive in front of 500 people.
How long
mesmeric.
It is. How long do you think it takes a comedian, and then to that, how long did you figure it took you to trust yourself on stage fully?
I don't want to sound too humble because I'm pretty amazing, but I'm also humble. Oh God, I've got it all.
But the
idea of we're getting better, that's the sort of thing you don't realize because you're on TV or you get booked for a couple of shows. People think, oh, he's the finished product, or you get a special and you think, oh, he's the finished product. And I hope we've got incredible longevity. Comedian. So I was chatting to Jim Norton. We either die in our 40s from drinking drugs, or we play till we're 90.
Yeah.
Is that crazy? Or you're Don Rickles.
Look at how many great comics came a little bit late to the game. They got super good. Louis C.K. was always a good comic, but somehow at 45,
then he had kids, right?
He just looked kind of perfect. I think he grew into his persona. Like, it doesn't make sense to have that persona when you're 25.
Right.
Like, who's this guy?
Yeah.
But it's so. Like, to have a bit of experience, even if you're a one-liner guy like me, I think there's potential to just to get better at it as you move through life.
So you have to grow into a persona?
Oh, sorry, dude.
It's going to be tough, man.
Never going to be good at this.
You're never going to reach your full potential.
Because
it's always 5 inches above you.
But yeah, we were talking because Adam saw Martin Short perform here.
Oh, how was that?
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Truly inspiring.
And he's
66.
Yeah, 66.
Still relevant. The entire package of the show was just beautifully put together. He had the Man on the Street interviews, the character work, his topical social commentary on the political candidates. It was incredible. And, I mean, he didn't seem like he seemed like he was in his prime. And he would use some video clips to kind of set up certain moments. And you're like, oh, you were incredible 30 years ago, and you're just as good, if not better, right now. And I think that's... I don't know what you, throw that to.
I think that's a really interesting point, though. The idea that you would aspire to getting better in this business because it's, you're kind of growing up in public and you go, but my favorite bands are bands that get better. You know, it's that thing of like in music, I think, is the sort of most, the easiest analogy for what we do. And the idea that, you come out the first albums, kind of that's what you're defined and marked against. But then hopefully, it's not everything.
Yeah.
Not a one-hit wonder.
Yeah.
And you've had how many specials now?
Nine.
Wow.
9 hour specials.
Oh, no, most of them are 2 hours in the UK, or 90 minutes in the UK. They'd be a lot longer.
Because no
that DVD kind of format, the hour over here is like over there, you would want it to be 90 minutes.
Really?
Yeah.
People want more content over there, or what?
Well, yeah, in the UK, I do a 2 hour show with an interval, and here it's like they want 70 minutes, really.
Wow.
It's a different sort of.
Where do you have favorite spots to perform it in the UK?
No, I mean, I love playing everywhere. I love traveling. I mean, I like the idea of going. You know, this year, this is my 16th country this year. So I've done Australia, New Zealand, Iceland, Germany, Sweden, Finland, Malta. Just, I mean, everywhere.
And now, do you think, what about your comedy and what you do translates and makes it possible for you to go anywhere?
I think it's, you know, it's people are quite anglophile when it comes to comedy. People will come out and see stuff. Because obviously, there's no such thing as TV networks in the way that they used to be. It used to be that someone at the network at NBC decided what you were watching on Tuesday night.
Right.
Said, okay, we're going to put Friends on, and then we're going to put a repeat of this. Great. Everyone in? Yep. Okay, that's what we're watching. Now people watch what they want, when they want. Mm-hmm. So globally, the market is changing. I mean, part of the reason to do the thing with Netflix is it goes global on day one.
Yeah, right.
It's so perfect.
Yeah.
It really is kind of mind-boggling to me that anybody that has the opportunity to do it with Netflix doesn't, like, go somewhere else.
I think there's still, you know, there's status to doing HBO, mm-hmm. but I don't think people see it in the same mm-hmm. volumes.
No way.
And it's that idea as well. You don't want to preach to the choir. You want to convert some new people. That's the whole point of kind of putting out a special. And the idea with Netflix that it feels like it's free.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Like anyone with Netflix goes, well, I already own this.
Right.
And they've just put it on my, it's free.
Yeah.
It's fun. I bought this for House of Cards and they gave me this stuff as well. Well, I guess.
Yeah.
But then they might discover it.
Have you had new fans come out of the woodworks in the last year that they
Well, it
send
only
you
went up on March 18th. So mm-hmm. I think we'll see. I've chatted to a few people. They said, well, it takes a couple of months. But
even from like your live shows or like new countries you go to, I mean, having people come up and say, like, this is the first time I've seen you.
Not so far. But I mean, everything that was on sale was sold out before it came out. So
wow,
it feels like.
And then you were telling me this morning that the timing of that special could not have been worse in terms of like when you recorded it.
Oh yeah, I mean, I recorded in Hammersmith in London. It's a beautiful.
I know that. I studied abroad in London for 8 months. Loved it. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember you. you're the guy at the post office. I remember.
I was a guy drunk outside the Regent Park Zoo.
Sure. I lived just near there.
I studied the British American Drama Academy up on the top of that hill.
So oh, really?
Up the hill from Camden Town, like right next to the park. You know where it is? BADA. It's called the British American Drama Academy.
Come on, where's that? Is that up the hill from the park? What?
So Camden Town, right?
Yeah.
Straight up that hill. And then if you were to continue to Regent's Park.
Havistock Hill.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So past Belsize Park?
Yes.
This is very North London.
Yeah.
I live in Primrose Hill.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Gorgeous area.
In a condo. It's a fucking everything's a mansion to you. Even a drawer.
They put us in St. John's Wood.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Lovely, yeah. I live just off Avenue Road. You know it. Let's not get into this.
Okay.
Just Google it. It's a super nice neighborhood. Yeah. So I recorded on the Friday night, I did a warm-up show. We were just checking out lights, things. You know, we were just playing the show. So did the show. Great first half. Like, did about an hour and 10 minutes. Thoroughly enjoyed it. The interval. Got off stage. Tour manager's like white as a sheet. Saying, you got to see the news, man. And Paris was in the midst of happening.
No.
So the BBC News was like, this is happening, and then there were almost immediately kind of threats about, oh, is something going to happen in London? Is this a because people thought it might be an attack that was organized
and
around
then,
Europe.
And then this is a time where, like, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, during an intermission, no one would find out about this yet.
Everyone knew in the
but
second
everyone
half.
Knew because they're all checking their phones.
Well, then, so that wasn't the night we taped. We taped the next night.
Yeah.
20% of the audience didn't come because they were scared to come into London, I guess, or 10% of the audience. But, like, that's, you know, on a sold-out show, when you're doing your special, you want it to be
full. Yeah,
if it can be full, be
full. I mean, it was maybe 10%. It was fine.
Yeah.
But that thing of also everyone drank too much.
Mm-hmm.
It was it was one of the toughest gigs on the tour. It was because people were kind of hammered. And I think it was that they were out and a bit nervous and everyone's
taking
feeling a bit uncomfortable. Why are we going out tonight?
Maybe if we do get bombed, I want to be fucked up so I don't completely feel and notice everything. Maybe.
Maybe. Who knows? Yeah. Good plan.
But So
it was weird. I mean, I'm so pleased with the way the edit came together.
So you got through that show, though. I mean, you still...
Oh, yeah.
There was usable...
You know, it was a good show. I mean, I did maybe 2.5 hours that night.
No kidding.
I knew that I did way too long on every single piece of audience work. Because I knew I wanted that in the show.
Yeah.
So the amount of stuff that we left on the cutting room floor that kind of just didn't feel right, and we tightened it up, and, you know.
Wow. How do you remember 2.5 hours of one-liners?
It's my job. my only job.
Did anybody ever bring up the attack during the show, or did you? I mean...
No, I mean, I do a bit about Charlie Hebdo at the end of the show.
Yeah,
yeah.
There's a big finishing piece, which is a Charlie Hebdo joke. So, yeah, it gets a mention.
Yeah.
But I'm very pro-ISIS, so that would be my problem. Does anyone ever go, those guys, come on, they got a come on,
they're not that bad. You're seeing it wrong. Get to know them.
Have you seen their videos? Great cinematographers. Yeah. Fantastic.
Who had the bit about that? Dave Chappelle had a great bit about that.
Oh, yeah?
About watching ISIS videos and kind of why was he doing it. Like, and what can you do when you watch this?
Yeah.
Don't like. Such a brilliant bit.
Is he one of your favorites?
Yeah, I saw him last year in Montreal. Yeah. I went with a buddy, and just seeing someone have that much fun on stage is so inspirational. When you see someone on stage, you just go, oh, he's having more fun than any of us. I mean, he's loving this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And making himself laugh and just... He's magnificent, yeah.
Now, you have a very distinctive laugh, so when you go to see comedy shows, do comedians ever call you out because they know you're in the audience?
No, I've gone to see you a lot, but then my laugh has never really come into play. It's always been fine. Yeah, occasionally I get like, you know, it becomes a thing, and it's quite a weird laugh. I laugh on an in, not an out. Okay. So instead of ha-ha, it's ha-ha, ha-ha. It's a really weird honking goose of a laugh.
Do you remember the first thing that made you laugh, like, really gutturally?
I guess school, you know, that thing of like, oh, my God, I'm going to wet myself. It's like, it's too fun.
Yeah. That school thing, you
know,
was.
School.
Yeah.
School was like.
You had a blast.
Yeah, just people being hilarious.
And then did you always laugh like that, or was that like you did
no,
that
I think
in
it was,
puberty
I think
or
I
something?
Laughed, I laughed like that. My mother had narcolepsy, like a narcoleptic laugh.
Uh-huh.
So when she laughed, she didn't make any noise at all and kind of lost a bit. It almost looked like she was kind of having a stroke. She would like just kind of...
just like, is mom dying? Oh, no, I just said something funny.
Yeah, which, you know, it was like she had a weird, silent... And she was a hilarious woman, but she had this weird thing. If something got her, she would just...
And that made you laugh?
Yeah.
Who was the funniest in your family?
Her by like a million miles.
Really?
What was her...
She was just kind of a larger-than-life Irish lady, was very... Mm-hmm. Was everyone's favorite. I had a lot of friends when I was growing up that would like... I'd come home from college and they'd be in my house drinking tea...
What?
...with my mother. And you'd go, what?
She was a great storyteller or what?
Yeah, really good storyteller. Yeah. Just really good
charismatic,
fun.
Charismatic, yeah.
Yeah, very charismatic, very fun. Huh. I think that thing of like... We were chatting about it the other day. The people are always... Psychologists are always looking for unifying factors.
Yeah.
Like, what brings all comedians together? I think most comedians I know had a sick parent. Maybe not physically sick, maybe depressed, but they had someone in their life when they were small that they needed to cheer up, and laughter had a greater currency as a result of that.
Yeah.
I see that in, like, so many comedians.
Yeah. And so who was that for you?
Oh, well, I think my mother was a little bit sad.
Yeah.
She was the life and soul of the party, but I think there was an undercurrent of, you know, a little bit of depression there going on. And I think that thing of... cheering her up was an incredible catharsis and the most fun thing.
And then when did you make the transition of just making my family laugh?
Oh, sorry.
Still a man. No, but like when do you think yourself I can do this as a career?
I was like mid-20s. I was 26 when I went, I might try comedy.
What were you doing before then?
Working for Shell in marketing.
Jesus. Really? That's hilarious.
Yeah, it's a...
Did you like that? You seem like you'd be pretty good at
that. No one likes that.
But you did it because what? It seemed like the right...
Yeah, I was like...
You just graduate, you get a job.
I was a parent's wet dream. I think doing comedy was the first decision I made. Like, everything else was the line of least resistance.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think of like, are you going to do A-levels? Of course. Like, finish school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to go to college? Yeah. Which one? The best one I can go to. Well, I went to the best one. And what are you going to do afterwards? You're going to get a job. Who with? Well, the best, biggest company I can, blue chip, I don't know, something.
Yeah.
It was the line of least resistance. Then eventually just, I'm done with this.
And folks were supportive when you...
No, my mother was kind of supportive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, no.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, I'm assuming you're working for Shell. You got a great salary, and then all of a sudden you're
not
like, no?
Not that great. Not compared to show business. Come on, we can be open with people. This is a brilliant business.
Well, look at these colorful mic covers we got. Like, you think these were cheap?
It just feels like it's a grift, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You go, what no one ever talks about is the fact that, of course, we would do this anyway. If they said, oh, there's no money in comedy, you need to work in a 7-Eleven every day, but you get to do the comedy show, we'd go, yeah, fine,
1,000%.
Yeah.
Isn't that fucking crazy?
We just don't want the word to get out about it. Because
I think kind of musicians
really
as well. There's very few musicians I know that have any choice as to what they do. Whether they're successful or not, they go, yeah, well, this is who I am.
Yeah, Keith Richards talked about that in his book where people say like, oh, don't you want to take a break? Or don't you want, it's like, or like when he goes on vacation, he plays guitar. Everyone's like, why don't you stop? He's like, no, I don't stop. This is what I
do.
This is who, yeah, it's an identity level thing. Well, yeah. It is that weird thing of, I love that quote, find something you love doing and you'll never work again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely...
Yeah, it's great. I think, who said that? Was that?
It was me just now.
Yeah. I want to know.
Pay attention.
I want to know Jimmy because Carr, I remember walking up to school and seeing there was, I think, a couple elementary schools on that hill. Hammersmith Hill, is that what it was? Walking up from Camden Town?
Haverstock Hill. Yeah.
Haverstock, yeah. And so there was large groups of elementary school British kids. And they
is
seemed
this
like.
Is going to be a sexy story?
Yep. Straddle up.
Okay, come on.
Oh, so, take it out. So these they were always laughing in groups, these kids, and I was so curious. I was like, and they seemed like I was just what they were laughing at. So I guess I'm curious, like, what you said school was a blast. Like, what was it about growing up in England and like the like at school at that time? What's funny? Like, what are you guys laughing about?
Is that different? It's kind of a difficult question because it feels to me like it was it's all you had to be there. It's all like that, you know, your little world. The idea that you first go to school and make your own friends, you're outside of your family,
yeah,
and you're picking people based purely on, you're not picking your friends based on looks, you're picking them based on who makes you laugh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and we got to hang out more.
Yeah.
So you that little clique of people that, oh, you got the same sense of humor, you like messing around. And
but people on the whole say that, you know, like comedy overseas is, you know, different than it is in the States, right? Like we're more hit you over the head with jokes and you guys are a little more subtle. You don't hear those comparisons ever?
Yeah, nonsense. I don't know who's, you know, I think people are desperate to find a difference. I don't think there's, I play over here, it's virtually the same. I'd say the only difference between playing in Europe and America is occasionally an American crowd will get a little bit applause happy. Mm. And they get, if they like a joke and they laugh, they will also clap.
Yeah.
In the UK, very, well, certainly not for me. Right. They'll get to the end of the show and have a round of applause, but they'll just laugh the way through.
Yeah, then you go to, like, Japan and they're more silent, but then they're still appreciative, like they'll come up to you afterward and just be like, "That was the greatest thing ever." It's like, well, why weren't you guys laughing? Because they think they're interrupting you.
So I should probably just say for the listeners,
yeah,
Brad died in Japan. He had like awful gigs, and we have to, you know, the way you have a child or dwarf in your life, and you don't want them to be upset, so you tell them a story. It's like, you know, Santa Claus or Jesus or whatever one of those kind of bullshit things is. So that he's not upset. So we told him that, oh, no, Japanese people, at the end of the show, they really enjoyed you. Yeah. No, a lot of them just, they will always walk out if they're really enjoying the show. They'll say, that's enough laughter for me. And then they'll leave.
Wait, you guys did shows over there together?
No, I was doing a bit. It's sort of a comedy thing.
Well, your acting is phenomenal. Do you act, or do you prefer to act, comedy, or host?
Mm-hmm.
I like doing, you know, stand up's a fabulous thing, but it feels like it's a solo sport.
Yeah,
right? It's like it's tennis.
Yeah,
you're up there on your own. The audience is a part of that, and it's kind of at its best, it's a conversation. It feels like there's an ebb and a flow, but doing TV is like it's like a team sport, and it feels like it's like you arrived at a new school when you're hosting a show. So you arrived at the new school on the first day. They went, "You're amazing. We're making you head boy." And you go, oh, thanks very much. And also, everyone loves you. We think you're the best, and we all want you to do great. And you go, this school's the best school ever. And then, you know, so everyone's kind of job is to make you look good.
Yeah.
When you're hosting
yeah.
It's so fabulous. And I've been very lucky with the teams that I work with that, you know, you just feel like
you've hosted some,
so supportive.
I mean, a ton of shows. Some that I saw that I didn't even know. I mean, 100 people who look most like Jimmy Carr. That was a show?
No, I think you've misunderstood how Google works. These are...
This is Carr has hosted Channel 4 game shows, Distraction, and Your Face and Mine. He presented the 100 series of programs for 100 worst
pop. We did like a list show thing about 10 years ago, more maybe, where we did like the 100 scariest movies,
yeah.
And then we'd write a joke about every fifth movie or sixth movie. And then
those are fun, right?
They were really fun to do. Actually, that's kind of, when I got famous, I did those shows and was quite overexposed. So one Christmas, there was like 3 of them on. They're like 4-hour shows.
They're kind of like the VH1 States ones, I Love the 90s and stuff like that. Yeah.
But it was just me down the lens doing...
You?
Yeah. It wasn't loads of
That's
people.
That's amazing.
Me. So, and then you would just do... But it was lots of clips and things. So scary movies or whatever the thing was. And you would... you'd write all the gags. Do it beyond for like, you know... 4 hours, and then there'd be another one on the next night. And then suddenly, I went from being, oh, you're the guy from the thing with the girl and the other, to being, oh, you're Jimmy Carr.
Wow.
You're on TV. Too
from those shows.
Yeah. Those, and then I did a thing called Your Face or Mine, which was couples came on the show, and they had to judge each other's looks by their, and then we'd bring on their exes, or celebrities, and they had to agree with the audience. They had to be realistic about their partner's
Holy
looks.
Holy shit!
Wow,
was that fun?
When you got famous, was that a drastic life change when people started recognizing you?
No, it's a very natural state. It's a weird thing where I think human beings, for I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of years, until maybe 3,000 years ago, we lived in tribes. We lived with 60 or 80 people in a tribe. Everyone knew everyone, and it was unusual, weird, to see a stranger. So it's quite comforting to be recognized. It's quite nice if you walk down the street and people go, hello, hello, hey, how are you? And also, if you're a comic, they're quite well disposed towards you. So you tend to meet people in quite a good mood. Occasionally you'll meet people and just go, hello, and they'll go, oh, you, what are you like? Oh, because they're projecting a memory of kind of comedy onto you. It's
The last time they saw you, they were laughing. So that's kind of like Pavlov dog thing.
Is there a place in... because you live in England currently, yeah?
Yeah.
In a condo. But it's a very nice condo.
Is there a place...
I sleep in an enormous drawer. It's like an open-top drawer. I don't know how you would describe it. With like a headboard.
Is it one of those ones that you have to pull out, or you can press it and then it opens on its own?
Oh, we have all of those. Yeah, don't worry about that.
Don't you worry about that. I saw, when I was studying abroad there, Ross Noble. Do you know who that is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, I know Ross.
He's a big... I was blown away when I think most of that show was all improvised, maybe, right?
Sometimes he's got a couple of set pieces within the show, but he often doesn't get to them. I mean, he's a remarkable performer.
I just wanted to.
He's amazing.
I thought it was.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's kind of your. I think if people know Noel Fielding and the Mighty Boosh, that they would like Ross. He's that kind of flavor. I mean, I love him.
When you started becoming a comedian, were your friends surprised, or were they like, oh no, that's what you should be doing?
I think they thought I was quite mad.
Really?
Like, most of my friends have got my friends from college certainly have got pretty good jobs, they were all doing very well at that kind of age, mid-20s, getting on, doing stuff.
So they're like, Jimmy, you know what?
I think Jimmy's having a bit of a crisis. I think he's driving around the country telling jokes to people. He doesn't have a job. Like, there was a bit of genuine kind of...
When you say it like that, it can sound kind of crazy. He's just driving around telling jokes to people.
For no money.
And especially...
For no money at all.
Right.
And he doesn't see... He said he's not going to get a job. He's just going to do this. He's just going to write... And he was writing silly jokes, and he told me one of them, and I thought it was weird. And, a genuine concern.
Now, I think people, they have that opinion because they didn't grow up with comedian friend, right? I mean, like somebody that was doing it and making it look tangible.
And it wasn't like I knew anyone else that had ever done it. It's not like I'd had any exposure at all, to anyone in the media or TV or...
Right, well, I mean,
I'm thinking if I'd met someone when I was 18 or 19 that worked on TV as a TV producer, I would have gone, I'll do that.
So you had no connections whatsoever, right?
None, I didn't know anyone.
Yeah, it's that thing where the only comedians you're really exposed to when you're not in the business are extremely successful ones.
Yeah.
I think you're quite right as well. When you go and see, Kevin Hart in a 16,000-seater venue, which might be someone that's listening to this, a young person, went with their family, it was incredible.
Yeah.
16,000 people eating out of the palm of his hand, what an incredible thing. I could never do that. And you're absolutely right, you could never do that. Mm-hmm. But if you go to the Chuckle Hut on a Tuesday night... Or like a little place above a bar, and so you've got to get so into comedy before you see someone at the level where you go, I could do that.
Yeah,
yeah.
And what was that for you?
There was going to little places sort of around Islington. You'd know the areas of in Soho, going to these little clubs in kind of tiny bars, and they put on comedy shows. A bit of a boom in comedy.
Yeah,
and thinking, oh, that guy was amazing. That guy, I think I could probably do that.
Now your style, the one-liners that you write, I mean, they're on the edgy side. You talk about some taboo topics. Was that always your intent?
No, I started pretty clean. I started much, much cleaner. And then I think it just, you get closer to your real sense of humor the longer you do this. There's less of an edit. There's less of that's maybe a joke for my friends, and this is a joke for the stage.
Did you always like sort of blue jokes?
Yeah, it's a weird thing to call them. I think that's the funniest stuff. I always just try and write. I mean, the audience decides ultimately if it's too much, but it's that thing of going, well, why wouldn't you joke about that? There's a lot of the easy. It's an easy topic. Anything that's edgy, it feels like there's a lot of tension around, and the release of tension is kind of what laughter's about.
Yeah.
Even in a microcosm, in every one-liner, you're telling a story. telling two stories, really. The setup is one story, and in the setup, you're making people make an assumption that turns out to be erroneous in the punchline.
Yeah.
It's the sudden revelation of a previously concealed fact. And that idea that you go, well, if you start off with something in the setup that's everyone's a bit tense and uptight and thinking in one way, and then you can turn it on a sixpence and, you know, do something else with it, it's a bigger laugh.
You love that, yeah?
Yeah.
Where, is there any ever been a time where you've said a one-liner that you've then immediately had some remorse over and been like, oh, shit, that might have killed, but, like, it actually made me feel a little, or never?
No, I think if it gets a laugh, fine. Yeah. The audience, I think, is, I love that Lenny Bruce thing. The audience is a genius.
Yeah.
They're the arbiter of taste and funny. Mm-hmm. They decide what is and what isn't acceptable and what is and what isn't funny, and that'll do for me.
So you think if it'd be wrong to ever get combative with an audience and be like, you know, some comics will be like, fuck you, that's funny, like, why didn't you laugh at that?
We're talking about Joe DeRosa.
I don't want to say his name.
That's mean. Yeah. Some great comics.
Yeah. Have you ever done a joke that's gone, that's got you in trouble?
Yeah, a lot, yeah. An awful lot. I did one recently. I was on this TV, genuinely, just before Christmas. Mm-hmm. I was on a TV show in the UK called The One Show. Early evening, 7 in the evening, like a news kind of current affairs show.
Yeah. Right.
And you go on it to promote the tour. They get huge viewing figures. So you go on. And they said, oh, tell us a joke. And the guy really kind of put me on the spot. It's a live show. I'm there with Rod Stewart. And they said, tell us a joke. And I went, you know, it's going to be clean and it's got to be pithy.
Yeah.
So I said, dwarf shortage. That's the quickest joke I know.
Dwarf shortage. Yeah.
And then it's a two-word joke. And then I said, I could see the host kind of going, ooh. And I said, if anyone's offended by that at home, grow up. And we got complaints about it, but like...
joke?
They upheld the complaints about it because it was early evening, and they said not only did he make the joke, but he also made a remark afterwards.
It's called a tag.
Yeah. What we do.
Denigrating the struggle of the itty-bitty people, or whatever the fuck.
Itty-bitty or whatever the fuck? Did any dwarves call in? Like, yeah. Did it heighten the cause?
Did it heighten the cause?
Easy.
Wow, Jared. Easy. How dare him.
But that thing of... it's a weird thing, I suppose. You know, when someone complains about that, because you kind of go, well, you know what? If you're going to be offended by that, good luck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not for you.
No. And... because like you say, like, wow, I've got other stuff. Like, you did that joke is insane, like, not offensive at all. So the people that got offended that they wouldn't like your live show if a two word
well, there's also,
dwarf
there's,
joke
there is a height requirement,
son of a bitch.
Do you think there's something too where people, like, maybe the play on words goes over their head and they get pissed that they didn't pick
over up over their
on
head
it?
I get it.
But you know what I'm saying, like, where they didn't pick up on it, like, some people just aren't good listeners or whatever, and that's a very clever play on words with those.
Well, no, I don't think so. I think it's often the case that the people that complain about a joke are actually people that are in a member of any kind of group within society.
Yeah,
and they have a job to publicize the effect of that. You know, the problem. So let's say it's a pressure group for small people in the UK, and they say we want to stop bullying in schools for small people, and we want to, you know, so they go after the comedian because it's a very obvious quick thing to do,
and
to say, but they're not actually offended, they're just going, this is great for our cause, we'll get a piece in the paper.
They have to justify their existence, because if they don't get upset about certain things like that, then why are they needed? They're not. So
I'm curious about something. The same way that
is
like
it guys and what they'd feel like.
Yep.
He's not curious, he knows.
When Princess Di passed away, right? I'm curious, like, when 9/11 happened in the States, you know, like, you hear comedians David Cross, Greg Giraldo, they would talk about, like, people would come out to comedy clubs almost like a couple days after, right? Because they just wanted to heal, they wanted to laugh, they wanted to kind of, like, escape. Was, you know, obviously that was a huge tragedy. Like, was there a similar response?
It's weird. The only one that I've come across, there is one... the place that I've noticed it most is South Africa.
Okay.
So in the UK, Diana, not a problem. You could absolutely talk about that because the outpouring of grief was so, and the media attention that it got was so, within like 3 days, it was so overpowering.
Yeah.
It was a very sad event.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like, it felt like, yeah, a woman died in a car crash. That's an awful thing, but the country's losing its mind. And I think it was because it was the Jungian archetype. I think it's she was the tragic, unhappy princess in a tower that that resonates with everyone.
To rescue.
That's part of our collective unconscious memory. That's why it was such a huge thing. And so it was fine to joke about that. The only place I've really noticed it was South Africa. You cannot really do a Nelson Mandela joke. I mean, it's just not a Winnie Mandela joke. You cannot.
Who's Winnie? Is that the
Winnie Mandela's the wife?
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, because that. I mean, he ended apartheid. Like he ended. He changed everything. So he's a deity there.
Unsayable.
Has anyone tried? Have you heard examples of people that
there
tried?
There is one topic in the UK that's kind of the same. I think there's a. We had a football tragedy in. It was awful football tragedy called Hillsborough, where many, many people lost their lives in a crush, and it's a non. Couldn't do a joke about that, and rightly so. I think it's a lot of people feel like there was no justice for the victims, and that, you know, they blamed them for pushing or whatever. So it was that's another thing that I think you wouldn't want to go there. And the audience is ultimately always the arbiter. The audience tell you immediately. Yeah. So I'm sure people have tried, and the audience just would go, no, it's not for us, thanks.
Because you do hear comics say like nothing's off limits, and I'm like, I mean. I think there are exceptions.
I suppose you would have to have an angle on it that has to be. You'd have to say something so funny and so brilliant that everyone would go, no, okay, that's a really. That's
and that
great.
Is possible. You've heard.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, the stuff that. I don't joke about race particularly. It's much more taboo in the UK to joke about race than it is here.
Yeah.
Even doing the Opie and Anthony show earlier, not the Opie and Anthony, Opie and Jimmy. Anthony, let's talk about race. but the idea that people are openly talking about, Jews and blacks in a way that really feel, it makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable because my tradition is not, that's not a thing.
Oh, really?
And here it
and
seems.
And when that happens, do you just not chime in because you. That's not your wheelhouse.
Like, it's not my thing.
Interesting. Now,
you see Chris Rock talk about it, or you see Jim Jefferies talk about it. And you go, it's fine, fine for them. Mm-hmm. But they had an angle. They had something to say.
Yeah.
Do you ever look at a topic that's sort of taboo and like look at it as a challenge to yourself? Like, I wonder if I can make this funny, or do you just write whatever comes to your head?
No, it's whatever comes into my head. Whatever I'm.
Yeah.
Happens to be in the news or thinking about that day or
so based on your act you think about pedophiles a good 75%
of
the day.
Weird actually that is another as another area of like they are the boogeyman. Mm-hmm. they're the kind of the monster in the closet kind of in our society. I'm sure they can't be any more prevalent than they ever were. But the idea that you go it's a terrifying threat at all times, it's like the creepiest thing,
right? And but like that's just what you were writing about. Like you didn't sit down and go, I'm gonna write a great
No, it's like they're just too easy to write. The line of least resistance.
How many jokes, like when you're like gonna do a late night set, like you've done Conan a bunch, right?
Yeah, I did the Tonight Show last month.
Oh shit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How many will you rehearse that set a bunch? Will you just kind of write a thousand jokes and then pick the best ones or
No. I'll just take jokes from my current tour show, but it's like 18 jokes. It's a very weird thing doing the Tonight Show for me. I was chatting to Dimitri about this the other day, how some comics are like, I went on the road and I practiced and I honed that 4.5 minutes and got it right. For us, it's like, if you're a one-liner comic, you go, 4.5 minutes, okay, 18 gags, maybe 19 just in case for Ty get the timing wrong on something.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Boom, done.
And is there
how long did that take? 4 minutes.
God, that's... We're doing it wrong.
It's a cut and paste.
That's fucking, yeah. But I mean, then there's an order to those 18. No, or is
it? Like a little bit, but I mean, not. You wouldn't need to be. So I went and ran that in New York a couple of times at the Cellar. But
one thing I like about your one-liners is even though you're telling jokes that aren't true and that like they're when you say my girlfriend, like it's not. But when you're done,
all of them are about your girlfriend. Yeah.
But like when you're done, I still feel like I know who you are as a person. Whereas some one-liner comics, I don't feel like I know them.
It's a weird thing that like you get a general sense of something kind of comes through in the in the ether of it, or just chatting to people, and they get a feeling of this guy's just it's weird.
Mm-hmm.
Jim, what was the first joke you remember writing or doing on TV or doing in a special that you just remember going like, that's quintessential Jimmy Carr? Is that a difficult question to answer?
No. I remember writing a joke that was, I'd like to take this opportunity to recommend Korean food to each and every one of you. Their delicacies are the dog's bollocks. I don't know how well that translates in North America, but not bad by your reaction. But I remember writing that and going,
it's good.
Oh, that would work anywhere. That's just like, I remember my friend Daniel saying to me, oh, that, do that in 20 years, that'll still work. It's still, it's a fun little,
yeah,
very quick.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, it just works.
Do you have bits like that that you've done? Because you've been doing stand-up for how long?
Yeah, I've been doing stand-up maybe 15 years now. Maybe a bit longer, maybe 16 years.
So obviously you're trying to, I mean, always write and out with the old and with the new. But I mean, like you just said, there's stuff you can't hold on to.
Well, I'm doing at the moment, I'm doing in the UK, I'm just launching, I'm doing a best-of tour.
That's incredible.
So I'm taking like 10 minutes from each of the specials, my favorite 10 minutes.
Wow.
And doing a 2-hour show where I just play the hits like I'm the Rolling Stones.
That's fucking brilliant.
I mean, I've done the previews and it's going great. Like, because no one goes, heard it, or tell us some new jokes. It's like, because there's a big thing behind me saying the ultimate, it's called the ultimate best of Golden Greats hits tour.
That's
it's like,
is that a working title or is that
No, it's something like that. It's the best of ultimate gold greatest hits tour.
That's incredible. What a great idea, because I always think of that, like when I hear like Louis say, like, once I get that hour, now I'm done with it, whatever. I'm just like, you know, I mean, I'm 9 years in, so I can't.
I don't work as well on storytelling.
Because you know that
if you've got a 10-minute story and there's one big turn at the end.
And you know it. You're right.
Good luck.
You're right.
Yeah.
I was chatting to David Cross about this last night, because I was saying, I think you can still tour after you've done the Netflix special. He went, I don't think you can. If you're doing a 12-minute bit and it's got one brilliant line at the end.
Right.
And you've all that set up and then the release. If you know where it's going,
he's kind of right.
Whereas if you're a one-liner guy, you go, you're not going to remember all of these. I barely remember them.
Yeah. Right. And then even if you do, it's going to be over in 30 seconds.
And there's another one.
You'll get a new one.
The amazing thing I found doing the first couple of previews was people just were convinced that there was new stuff. People come up to you that I've seen you 10 years in a row and would go, really enjoy the show, some classics in there. And quite a lot of new stuff I noticed. You go, no, none of that was there. It's all been on my spot. And they went, no, but quite a lot. No, actually, there was quite a lot of new stuff. And you go, no.
They're arguing you about your material.
Of course. Well, that's something from being John Malkovich.
Yeah.
No, I'm pretty sure you're in it.
Yeah. Well, because in a 90-minute show, a one-liner comic will do, geez, how many jokes? Like, so, like, and
300 maybe?
Yeah, and they're not going to remember all. They're not going to remember all of them. And I love that you make you're not trying to fake it. You're not being like, it might be new material. Like, no, you're telling them. This is jokes that I've written before.
Well, the frustrating thing at the moment is writing new material. I'm writing quite a lot at the moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's for the next tour. It doesn't start for like 2 years. It doesn't.
Holy
it's like,
shit.
Wow.
No, actually, probably 3 years.
Why 3 years? Because
I've got to tour the UK. That takes about 2 years because I'll do 200 shows.
Maybe there's that many spots in the UK, huh?
Yeah, well, some cities I would do, because I like to play like a 1 or 2,000 seater, so I won't play the bigger rooms. I'll just do that, but I'll do it maybe 5 times in somewhere like Cambridge or Reading. I'll just play multiple gigs.
It's amazing.
And go to every town in the UK and Ireland, and then I've got Australia to do, and then the rest of the world, America.
Is there a country, I mean, probably by his hometown, but I mean, is there a place that just absolutely is gargling Jimmy Carr juice?
By the way, that's the name of your next special.
There's a few places that are very special to play. Liverpool is one of them. It's like an amazing town to do comedy.
Yeah.
Because if you get them there, it really feels like, especially on a Saturday night, it's like the perfect town. Or Glasgow, get them on a Saturday.
Is it because they don't have a lot of entertainment or comedy?
No, it's because they the importance attached to a sense of humor in those towns is so high. Their collective pride in their sense of humor is so crazy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like doing the... we've got about 8 more minutes. Is that cool? Are you good on time?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When you do like Fallon and the Tonight Show or Conan, do you meet with them? How important is it to you that like they... Like that you become, I don't know, get chummy with them pre-show, or that they like your stuff?
I mean, doing Fallon recently, I just thought it was... he seems like a really nice kid, and I think it's nice that he gets to meet me. I just felt like a... I felt like, you know what?
You were doing it for him.
This guy works hard. He deserves this.
Now, are you making any kind of conscious effort to expand more in the United States, like have another U.S. show?
Not so much. I signed up with an agent last year in Montreal. I met this guy, Max Burgos, out of...
That's my guy, APA.
APA. I just love him.
He's great.
And he kind of said, look, I think you should be doing more. I think you haven't really done much here, and it's, you know...
He's spot on with that, and
you
should.
Yeah, it feels like actually that relationship is quite important, and he kind of said, well, you know, you should do more, and let's get you out a couple of times and do some stuff. So he's really kind of pushing me, and I really like it. It feels to me like after you've been in this game, I don't know, 15 years, whatever it's been, I know we're very privileged and it's an amazing job, but sometimes it can get a bit samey. You know, if I'm gigging in the UK for 2 years,
sure,
doing my thing, I'm there on my own all the time. Coming to festivals, traveling, doing this thing, keeping it fresh.
Yeah.
Making it feel like, oh, it's, this is cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And doing it in a new city, right? I mean, you said you've never been to Austin?
No, never been
and
to
the
Austin.
And your shows have been, you have one tonight, right?
No, I'm just doing a spot tonight, but I had one last night, which I really enjoyed.
And it was great, huh?
I mean, not for me to say, but wink. Yeah. No, it was really fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw you in Montreal, I selfishly was like, you know, went to like look at your tour dates and like didn't like, I have, you know, I'm from Seattle. So like my folks and all my friends, I was, you know, telling about you, some of them who know of you from the distraction stuff. And then, yeah, I see on this, I'm like, oh, not anytime soon are you going up there. And it was like, I was like, oh man, I wonder when
that's. I think I might, you know, sort of 2018 is what I'm thinking about. I might try and do every state in the union. That's what I was thinking. I'd love to really travel.
You should.
America and see a bit more of it. I love it as a country. It's kind of, you know.
Would you ever think about doing some sort of like cross country documentary on, you know, fish out of water?
Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, what I would need is a dwarf carry-on.
I know a guy.
Those are pricey.
Yeah.
I know
that
a guy.
That guy from Game of Thrones seems super funny.
How dare you? Wow. Are you trying to...
Dinklage reference.
Yeah, that's the one thing that sets Brad up.
Is, like, between hosting comedy, like, is...
He genuinely, though, seems like a really funny guy.
Dinklage?
Seems like, yeah, I think he could be a stand-up. He's like... He just seems naturally funny. He doesn't seem to have to force it.
The vein is really about funny. To pop out.
He seems like a really funny...
Jimmy, I've taken a lot of your shit.
No, but he oh, wow. I can't believe this is a thing.
It's a real thing.
Yeah.
It's a real thing.
We're competitive. He doesn't know who I am, but we're very competitive.
Yeah. Sure. It's better that way. One day they'll meet.
Yeah.
One day they'll meet below the knee.
Sure.
But like,
I would not want to be at that pantomime.
I'm just like, between all the hosting and stand-up and acting, is there something you haven't done yet?
Yeah.
That you want to do?
Write a book? Voiceover.
I wrote a book about jokes with years ago. That's kind of that was a fun thing to do.
Just,
I wrote
it just how to write a joke, or
no? It was sort of the history and psychology and anthropology of jokes. It's quite. It's kind of. It was a little bit of a tiny bit intellectual, I suppose. It was like it wasn't like at the time the vogue in the UK was to do kind of celebrity biographies.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Just talk about your childhood. And I got a book deal and went, no, I really want to do something that's fun about something that I care about.
Yeah,
and I care about jokes. I know it's weird, but I do.
Do you consider yourself you have to be smart to be in comedy, would you say? Like,
I don't know. No, I mean, you know, I think that, look at those lovely blue-collar guys.
Yeah.
No, I think there's a certain level of, you have to be good with words. I mean, there's different kinds of, some people would be terrible at stand-up, but they're astrophysicists.
Yeah.
Let's not get carried away with ourselves. I think we're obviously going to use our marker as well. I mean, if you judge intelligence by the ability to make people laugh, we are very, very bright.
Right.
Yes, but no one is judging it like that other than us.
You don't have kids right now?
Hmm?
You don't have kids right now, do you? Or do you?
What now?
Have kids?
No, my girlfriend and I can't have children the way we do it.
What way is that? And with the clothes on?
Amazing.
Anal?
In the butt, Adam.
I was trying to see if...
For a comedian, it really feels like jokes really kind of knock you for six. It's like, well, he's done another bloody joke. I can't take this guy seriously.
No, I wanted to hear you say anal in that fun accent you have.
You looked so kind of... Yeah. Oh, shit, I've said the wrong thing.
No, I knew what it was. Come on, I'm with you.
Are you sure?
I wanted to hear you say anal in that lovely accent.
I want to hear you say anal. Freaky.
Wow.
Freaky. He's quite curious again.
You need something for the spank bank later.
Oh.
Sure.
So, no kids.
No kids.
But
no.
Is that something, like you mentioned earlier about, you know, needing stuff like that for, like, material?
Well, I saw Judd Apatow do stand-up the other day,
yeah.
And I thought it was really good.
A lot of
it. I really
kids.
Liked the idea that maybe in 10 years' time I would try and do some observational comedy. Maybe I would just try and switch it up and, like, not on tour, maybe just some club dates and just talk about my life, because I've got some kind of showbiz anecdotes that I would never dream of telling on stage.
What about on a podcast right now?
Let's save it.
All right.
This is where the big bucks are, right?
Yeah.
Do podcasts in hotel lobbies? Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we would love to hear those stories.
Yeah.
So I encourage that that idea for that show.
I think it might be quite a fun thing to do at some stage. Or maybe just to try and switch up styles.
Yeah.
Sure. It's one more challenge for you.
Yeah.
Mm. Also, comedy is always evolving. We should kind of change with the times, yeah?
Nice. Constant challenges. I mean, it's easy for you, Brad, because anything on a shelf.
Are you on social media at all? Is there?
I'm on Twitter. Yeah? I don't tweet an awful lot.
Really? I feel like that would be a great... Like, Brad uses Twitter a lot to test jokes.
One-liners.
And yeah. I feel like
it's giving them away. And yeah. I did it... I used to do sort of three a day every day. I used to do a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've got a lot of Twitter followers, but you feel like... You know what? It's giving stuff away. And people right. People are kind of dicks about it. People, you put jokes up there and they just go, yeah, it's a dad joke. Yes, because anything edgy I'm going to use in my act, or if it's super good, I'll keep it.
Yeah.
Right.
And then people pay to see me, and that's what I do for a living.
Yeah.
But it's kind of throwaway stuff, and they go, oh, boring. Don't like. All right. Unfollow me, maybe? I don't know. Yeah.
You have a choice in this matter.
Yeah.
What about on Instagram or Facebook? Just to promote shows? No.
No, I'm kind of... I think the Instagram thing's really interesting. I think it's not quite... appearing in Us Weekly, but it's close. I think you're letting people in mm-hmm. to an area of your life where you go, but there has to be a division of private and public life.
Yeah.
And if you start, you know, maybe a picture of the dog every now and then on Twitter, but do you need to show them the inside of your house and your car? And it
and
feels
the,
a bit
and the body like I
or
see.
The crib.
Yeah. Or the crib.
Or the music box that puts you to sleep at night.
Sort of like jail.
I'm not getting out, yeah. No.
He's gotten cogblogged by a baby gate before.
Yeah. Well, because, yeah, I was, it's a bit my act, but I got to a woman's house who had a kid, and she had the baby gate up, and I couldn't get over it. So I couldn't get back to the bedroom.
Well, that is funny and sad.
I was stuck, and I wasn't going to ask for help, no. You know, because that's kind of demasculating. You're like, hey, before I fuck you, can you just give me a little boost?
Wow.
Yeah.
That must be, I mean, I feel sorry for the kid as well when it walks in on you with its mum, and the kid goes, Mommy, I want to play with it.
Jimmy, thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thank you so
much. You're the man. This was a real...
It's very big of me.
Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Boy, they're a lot of fun, huh? Why don't you subscribe on iTunes to this fucking podcast? Give them a 5-star rating so this midget and this Jew can feel good about themselves for a couple minutes. Also, get on your iPhone or Android and get the podcast app. You can also listen to it on Stitcher or aboutlastnightpodcast.com, where you can hear past episodes with great guests like Lisa Kudrow, Paul Feig, Kevin Nealon, Bob Saget, Dion Cole, Chris D'Elia, Adam Devine, Michael McDonald, Jaleel White, Bud Friedman, Steve-O, Harlan Williams, Tom Arnold, Ron Funches, Rick Glassman, Blake Anderson, Anders Holm, Jessamay Peluso, Joey McIntyre, and many, many more. I'm Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast. Good night. That's it, right? You got it? Sweet. Boy, it smells good in that booth, by the way. What kind of candle is that? Hanukkah Willow? Nice.